reclaiming and honoring of our ancestral language. And for it to happen on what folks are now calling Indigenous Peoples Day was extremely serendipitous.
Residents of Barrow vote to change the city's name. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as marijuana businesses prepare to open, owners grapple with the problem of transporting it.
You want to make sure you make the right decision because we don't want your property seized.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
By a margin of 6 votes, residents of Barrow have voted to change the name of their city back to its Inupiaq name, Ukiagvik. City Council member Kyan Harcharik started the process this summer and joins us on the phone. Hi, Kyan.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being willing to talk to me today. And tell me, how badly did I mangle the pronunciation of your city's name?
It wasn't too bad at all. And I'm used to names getting mangled with their Inupiaq names, but also my name, Kyan Harcharik. So you did very good. I was impressed.
I realize Inupiaq words may not have a direct translation into English, but tell us about the meaning behind the name of your city now.
Sure. I guess it goes back to a conversation that some folks were having in the 1978 Elders Conference, and that question was asked, what does Ukiagvik mean? And one gentleman had mentioned that he recalled, it was as the whalers and outsiders began coming to Barrow and bringing in other goods, including different Western foods. One of them was potatoes, and I believe the word a word for potato is the utkik. And we also collect different types of roots. That are similar, that are starches and so forth. So it had to do with potatoes and I guess a place to gather potatoes.
Before absentee and question ballots were counted, the vote was tied. What were the objections to changing the name?
There's some folks that are afraid of change, and change is oftentimes a daunting task. And I believe it stems back to how well of a job that the missionaries and the Western folks in BIA schools, how good of a job they did on assimilating our people. And so, you know, Barrow, the name came from Sir John Barrow, from Frederick Beechey, naming this area after a buddy of his, and that took. And I think it has a deeper meaning to that than being that our people were severely punished for speaking our traditional language for many years. And a lot of those folks that are around today still have that internal oppression where they're afraid of that.
Kyan, why is this important?
It's important to me and many of us because our language is severely threatened. And I think it's time we begin healing, and this is a literal step into that decolonization.
Kyan Harcharik is a council member in Ukiagvik, the city formerly known as Barrow. For a decade, Democrat Bill Willikowski has represented an East Anchorage Senate district where Republicans outnumber Democrats by a wide margin. He attributes part of his success to one of the oldest political activities, knocking on neighbors' doors one at a time. This year, Republican Kevin Kastner is trying to beat Willikowski using his own door-knocking strategy. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman tagged along with both candidates yesterday as they made their pitches to voters.
It's starting to get dark as Senator Bill Willikowski walks through a quiet neighborhood of small houses. He says he casts a wide net in his search for votes.
I mean, some people target and only go to houses, you know,
persuadable houses or houses that are Democratic houses or Republican houses. I go to, if you vote, I go to your house. Hello, sir.
Hi.
Hey, I'm Bill Wilkowski, state senator, running for re-election.
Sure.
Just wanted to come by, leave you some information, see if you had any questions for me.
Don't have any questions.
Okay.
For you.
All right. Appreciate your support. Thank you,
Thank
sir.
You.
Have a good
Wilkowski's
one.
District has a lot more registered Republicans than Democrats. In the last election, the only precinct he lost was Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, the only area where he's not allowed to knock on doors. Wilkowski is a lawyer, first elected in 2006. He's been in the news this year for filing a lawsuit to keep full permanent fund dividends. Governor Bill Walker vetoed half of dividend funding. Wilkowski says the lawsuit's going over well.
A lot of people this time around are really talking to me about the permanent fund dividend. So, and I think that's because I have the lawsuit going, and that's a big topic for a lot of people.
No one answers at that house. But a few minutes later, a man tells Wilkowski he has his vote. Terry Legg is a retired drywall worker and thinks the lawsuit was a good move.
I'm glad he did it. I think there's a lot of people that really could use that money, and that there's a lot of other ways to get the money that the state needs besides taking it from the poor.
A mile and a half away, Wilkowski's challenger, Kevin Kastner, is also knocking on doors. He's the executive director of the Iron Dog race. He says he fixed the race's finances, and now he wants to be a lawmaker so he can do the same thing for the state. As he walks door to door in East Anchorage, Kastner relies on a mobile app that tells him which people are more likely to vote Republican.
My name's Kevin.
How you doing?
I'm Jay. Jay, nice to meet you. I'm running for state senate.
Oh, okay.
I want to introduce myself.
My wife met you.
She did.
Down at the picnic.
At a house with a well-groomed lawn, Jay Beverlin opens the door.
Frankly, my biggest concern is that, you know, we have a $4 billion deficit. And
well, I can fix that in a heartbeat.
Oh, really?
Well, I got a couple ideas, okay.
His first idea? A tax on marijuana. Economists have said that won't come close to solving the state's deficit problem. But Kastner tells Beverlin it's worth exploring. They also talk about the PFD cut. Beverlin has mixed feelings about it.
I can see what they're doing for a reason, but the other time, I'd like to see my money too.
Right.
But I don't want to see it all go away. As long as he doesn't spend it, I don't have a problem with it. But now if they go to spending it, then I have a problem with it.
The PFD lawsuit is the biggest issue in the election for many voters. And it's an issue Kastner and Wilkowski agree on. Kastner says the lawsuit may help his opponent politically.
Quite frankly, it's a good populist maneuver. But I'm on the same page.
It's not going to be easy for Kastner to unseat Wilkowski. The senator won re-election by solid margins two times. Kastner says he knows Wilkowski has a lot of name recognition, but he thinks he has a realistic chance of winning. Kastner raised nearly twice as much money as Wilkowski over the 2 months before October 7th. But the senator has much more cash on hand as their campaigns head into the final weeks. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Neither Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump or Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson will have a full page in Alaska's official elections pamphlet. The Alaska Division of Elections says neither candidate met the August 30th deadline. Presidential candidates need to submit a statement, photograph, and $300 fee to receive a full page in the election pamphlet. The Division of Elections sent letters in early August to the parties of both of those running for the presidency. Both Trump and Johnson are named in the pamphlet under a list of presidential candidates and will be on the November 8th ballot. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, burning the masks of aggravated organisms.
So one person told me once, masks are worn by one person, but this project is carried by the whole community.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska is just weeks away from its first legal pot shops opening their doors, but major issues are still unresolved, including how to legally transport marijuana from any community that's not on the road system. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports.
Mark Malagodi is the CEO of CanTest, a marijuana testing facility in an industrial patch of Anchorage tucked between the port and the railroad. Though they've been in the building a year, you'd never know it from the blank walls and near empty rooms, each devoted to pieces of lab equipment that look like photocopiers and Toyo stoves.
The machine that's on the right, which is called the Headspace Sampler, basically just heats the product up really, really hot, and that puts all the gases up into this tiny little tube.
Testing facilities like this one are an essential piece in Alaska's commercial cannabis industry. Whether you're growing bud, making pot brownies, or concentrates, a portion of each batch needs to be brought here. And then Malagodi's machines will test for potency, mold, and bacteria like E. coli. Testing labs are extremely expensive to set up and to keep staffed with technicians. Malagodi didn't want to share specifics about the purchase costs for the equipment itself, but when I asked for a price range on just one particular chromatography system, he tells me it's somewhere between a car and a house. The full capital cost is much, much higher.
It's like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
In the entire state, there are just two such testing facilities, both racing to open and both in Anchorage. Third lab in Juneau is several weeks behind. Malagodi expects the labs to begin testing as soon as an outside company accredits them.
That's one of the questions in Alaska right now is, you know, what's the volume going to be? So
for pot businesses on the rail belt, which is the vast majority, the transport system has all its pieces theoretically worked out. A grower can drive samples to a lab like CanTest and for services ranging in price from $70 to $220, have it certified. If that grower doesn't want to make the 14-hour round-trip drive from Fairbanks, or if businesses want added security, a private company called Valkyrie is currently set up to be the only transportation company with contracts to move cannabis. Valkyrie's armed guards are licensed by the Department of Public Safety and hired from the ranks of former military and law enforcement. But this system won't work if you're James or Gianno Barrett, two brothers who are 3 or 4 weeks away from having their first legal crop of marijuana ready at their business, Rainforest Farms, which is in Juneau.
We're still trying to figure out the transportation issue. It really depends on which law you're dealing with, which form of law, which branch, and which department.
Here is the conundrum for the Barrett brothers and any of the other Alaskans who have started the long and expensive license process in Nome, Dillingham, Sitka, and elsewhere off the road system. You can't ship your product to get tested at a lab without it going by mail, air, or sea, all of which are regulated by a federal agency. The Barretts will use the local lab in Juneau when it eventually opens, but until then, they're considering moving samples over water onto the road system, then driving it in. That doesn't break any state laws, but it wouldn't be kosher if the Coast Guard took an interest.
You want to make sure you make the right decision because we don't want your property seized. Maybe there won't be a charge out of it, but it's definitely a big inconvenience if your property is seized as a business, especially if it's everything you've been working for.
The Barretts are open about this because they're pretty sure that in the big picture, they're on the right side of the law. As justification, they point to the Cole Memo, a document from the Justice Department that basically says the federal government isn't interested in bringing charges against anyone in the pot business as long as they're obeying the state-level laws. Over the last few years, as states have legalized cannabis, regulators have used the Cole Memo as guidance when there are inconsistencies between state and federal laws. And James Barrett says that is exactly what he and his brother are counting on.
At some point, it's about interpretation and attitudes. And so I think that we should be safe by that.
Among all the agency representatives I contacted about transportation, everyone's answer boiled down to, we know what's legal and illegal, and if we see it, we'll take actions. But basically, we've got bigger fish to fry. A member of one federal agency said offhandedly that if there's no knowledge, then there's no problem. State regulators are banking on the Cole Memo, shielding residents from federal prosecution. At a meeting in April of the Marijuana Control Board, Cynthia Franklin, head of the regulatory body in charge of commercial cannabis, laid out the state's thinking.
Whether you're talking about postal police or Coast Guard or any kind of law enforcement associated with that transport, they all end up at one place, for their prosecution, which is the U.S. Attorney's Office.
And Franklin says, according to the Cole memo, U.S. attorneys have no interest in prosecuting these kinds of cases as long as businesses are meeting state laws. Back at the Cantest office, Mark Malagodi says that after 2 years of getting his business up and running, he can finally see the light at the end of the tunnel. He's excited that he's helped start a whole industry from scratch, but he's disappointed that between the expense and the absence of clear laws, rural Alaskans are locked out unless they're willing to risk breaking federal laws.
Certainly, as far as the spirit of what's been done here, it's frustrating in that, you know, it was opened up to Alaska and then denied to many of the Alaskans.
For the time being, Malagodi is trying to finalize his lab's accreditation so that he can start accepting samples by Halloween. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Last summer, Anchorage was facing a public health emergency from the synthetic drug known as spice. From July until November, ambulances brought an average of 7 patients to area hospitals every day. A new paper published by the Centers for Disease Control looks at what happened and why the spice outbreak has now largely stopped. Uri Springer works for the state's Department of Public Health and is the paper's lead author. Springer points to a chart showing medical transports for people who used spice. At first, there's only 1 or 2 ambulance trips a day. Then the numbers explode.
Then we hit the middle of July 2015, and we saw this large spike in the number of transports, sometimes exceeding 20 or 25 transports, ambulance transports a day for spice-related illness.
The municipality passed an ordinance which increased the criminal penalties for possession, sale, and use of spice. Springer says that's a large part of what's led to the drug's decline in Anchorage. He says this research paper is intended as a template for a successful intervention. During the 8-month period researchers examined, spice accounted for 10% of the city's ambulance transports. About 40% of the users reported that they were homeless. The paper appears in the October 14th CDC Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, transformation through fire. Museums are usually a place for appreciating art that will be around for centuries. But earlier this month, the Anchorage Museum hosted a ceremony to burn 10 beautiful Alaska Native masks. The artists who created the masks for an exhibit called Aggravated Organisms wanted to inspire community conversations about illness and healing. Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend was there.
Following Drew Michael around is like trying to keep up with a hummingbird. Michael is the Yupik artist who carved the 10 giant masks that represent diseases like cancer, HIV, and fetal alcohol syndrome. They're on display for the last time at Out North in Anchorage, where Michael alternates between being gracious host, smiling and hugging people who come in to sign and photograph the masks, and urgently sewing the harnesses that will be needed to allow dancers to carry the heavy masks before they burn.
How many more do you have to go?
I have no idea, because I'm doing steps at a time, so none of them are done yet. Am I going to be really tired tomorrow? Yeah, but it's okay.
He pauses for a few quiet minutes to reflect on what he hopes to accomplish the next day when he burns his creations.
But in the end, I don't really care about the pieces going away because it's really about the time for people to connect to their own emotions and then release those.
And 20 hours later, it's Saturday evening at a new venue, the Anchorage Museum. Aleutic artist Elizabeth Ellis is standing next to the masks that she painted after Drew Michael carved them. She says they worked well together, and she's proud of the masks. Her daughter is celebrating her half-birthday, full of six-month-old charm and wiggly smiles. As a mom of two young children, Ellis says painting the fetal alcohol syndrome mask was especially emotional for her.
It was hard to do. It was hard to translate onto a mask and how one would actually see that, especially as a mother. You know, I was being pregnant, and I've known multiple people that have gone through that situation.
Bumyuwa, the native musicians known for their tribal funk sound, keep the energy positive as volunteers don the recently sewn harnesses to dance the masks. Then Drew Michael announces it's time to go outside.
Okay, so the plan of events before everybody runs out, what we're going to do is, so one person told me once, masks are worn by one person, but this project is carried by the whole community. So what we want to do is kind of treat it like a funeral procession, and what we'd like people to do is go over to the masks and we can carry them.
One by one, people lift the masks to carry them out. Like a somber parade, we move onto the lawn of the museum and watch as the masks come to life through dance. Huge fire pits are behind us to the west. Michael and Ellis work together in this final artistic expression as they take the first mask and heave it into the flames.
Ready?
Ready.
Okay.
Woo! 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 Woo!
Oh my God. All right.
This one.
That was arthritis.
The heat is nearly unbearable, and it's difficult to tell if the tears on faces of those watching are from release of pain or smoke or both. One man crying and staring intently at the cancer mask as it is consumed by the flames politely declines to comment. But Cameron Willingham, firelight reflected on his smiling face, is delighted by being able to experience this art.
And I'll steal a quote from a friend of mine. We were talking about, you know, museum archives and library archives being like purgatory for art. It just goes there and it's in this gray, empty space, will never be touched again. You know, send it off, give it a second life.
Barbara Mayer lives in Anchorage and works in the medical field. She appreciates how the masks highlight illness and the hope for healing for Alaskans.
And we all have suffered from disease, and what a representation of the masks and the people, young and old. And it's just an awesome experience, and I'm honored to be here to get to witness the burning of saying goodbye to these spirits that we don't need, putting an end to what brings us ill health.
After all the masks are in the fire, Ellis and Michael stand close together, buoyant.
Happy, relieved, light.
I'm really happy that people have come up and said that this opened up something inside of them that has been locked in there for a long time. And I'm glad that I could work with you, Liz, and that we could do this together.
As the heat subsides, the charred masks flicker with their dying energy. In the twilight, people slowly start to move off as smoke and sorrow float away. For AK, I'm Lori Townsend.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Kate Mungin in Eureka. Mungin works and lives at the Eureka Roadhouse.
We're at Eureka Roadhouse at mile 128 on the Glen Highway. I live right here at the lodge. I was living in Palmer, and I was tired of just the city life. Came up here and been here ever since. I wait tables, I bartend, I clean rooms, I yell at employees. I've been here a little bit over 6 years now. I snowmobile, I four-wheel, I hunt, not successfully hunt, but I do go out and hunt. And I hike, and it's cross-country skiing, not my thing, too much work. I'd rather just hike. I had left, well, I'd been in Palmer another year. I left in 02, came back in 09. And then, so I've been back for almost 7 years now. But I moved here in 1994, originally. So I don't have to worry about the big city rush. It's not a rush up here, we're pretty mellow. We like to be mellow. It's not a town, it's pretty much just a vacation, recreational area. So I know there's at least seven of us here, year-round, at least. Differs every year. I mean, this area is building up quite a bit, so we have a lot more people from Anchorage that have cabins out here that come up on the weekends, snowbirds. So that's what's going on right now. They come up for the summers, leave for the winters. I don't know, because I lived in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho for a while, very similar. I lived at lodges, and it's all about the, you know, it's the same. The winters definitely here are longer. I mean, definitely longer. I think the tourists really think it's funny when the planes land on our highway. There's an airstrip right across the way here. You can't really see, but it is an airstrip. It's not maintained, so it is a bumpy ride. So the pilots know this, so they'll just land on the highway. It scares the heck out of oncoming traffic. You know, and they'll just pull on in, get gas, have some pie, and go on their way. As long as Jim and Darla have the lodge, and if Ryan takes over, yes, I'll be here as long as they'll have me. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. This is where I want to be. It's Ryan's son calls it Myrica. So we've all called it Myrica now.
Kate Mungin lives in Eureka. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Lori Townsend, Wesley Early, and Eric Bork. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge, Zachariah Hughes, and Andrew Kitchenman in Anchorage, and Amanda Frank in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. As an Alaskan, you love your salmon, but do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.